All right. Good morning. Thank you for coming so incredibly early after a late party last night. I think the bus I was on got in around 11:50. This morning, our session is on faith and climate change. Can prayer save the world? This is very apropos given Laudato Si, the Pope's Pope Francis's encyclical this year. But as Renee could probably tell you, there have been faith groups active in climate change for decades, probably at this point. So this is not a new topic, but it is a newly energized topic, thanks to the Pope. So let me first introduce our panel, and then before we actually start our discussion, since this is about faith, we thought it would be interesting to have appropriate to start with prayers from three different faiths here about Earth. Try to figure what you mean. No, that's not a signal. For the life of me, Kevin's going like this, and I'm going, there's something wrong with my mustache. And I can't figure why it would matter. So to your left, my far right, is Joan Rosenhauer, who's Executive Vice President of U.S. Operations of Catholic Relief Services. She's come just from Baltimore just for this panel, so we're very fortunate here. She has visited Catholic Relief Services programming in East and Central Africa, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, Southeast Asia, Caribbean, and Latin America. That really doesn't leave many places aside from Australia and Antarctica that she hasn't been to. She worked for 16 years for the Justice and Peace Office of the U.S. Conference of Bishops, and she has her bachelor's in social work and her master's in public policy management from the University of Maryland. So there are two of us here from Maryland. So. Now, for those of you who have been, and now next to me, Renee McPherson should be a familiar face if you've been. She was a panelist on the climate change and weather panel, and then she was, for those of us who went to the Moore tornadoes, she was also a speaker on that. She is the co-director of the South Central Climate Science Center and an associate professor of geography and environmental sustainability at our wonderful host, University of Oklahoma. And I believe, aren't you also the state formerly the state climatologist. And what's important for this panel, a practicing evangelical Christian. So I apologize, by the way, in your program it says Catherine Hayhoe. Catherine had to leave earlier than expected. So you saw her earlier in the program. So let's start with, why don't we start with Renee for her prayer, then Joan, and then I'll give you a prayer from Judaism, and then we'll start with Joan talking.
All right. Heavenly Father, thank you for your gift of creation, the scent of flowers, the taste of fruits, the sound of rushing waters, the feeling of grass beneath our feet, and the vision of beautiful landscapes bring us peace and comfort. Continue to remind us to recognize the many miracles of life around us and teach us how to respect and steward what we borrow from this earth during our short time here. Through our passion to know you more, let us learn to help our neighbors worldwide through everyday actions in our lives. Amen.
The prayer I'm going to read for you is one of two prayers that Pope Francis included in his encyclical Laudato Si, one of which is focused on Christian believers and includes the Trinity and whatnot, but the other one is really an invitation to all believers to join together in addressing issues of creation. And that's the one I'll read. A prayer for our earth. All-powerful God, you are present in the whole universe and in the smallest of your creatures. You embrace with your tenderness all that exists. Pour out upon us the power of your love that we may protect life and beauty. Fill us with peace, that we may live as brothers and sisters, harming no one. O God of the poor, help us to rescue the abandoned and forgotten of this earth, so precious in your eyes. Bring healing to our lives, that we may protect the world and not prey on it, that we may say sow beauty, not pollution and destruction. Touch the hearts of those who look only for gain at the expense of the poor and the earth. Teach us to discover the worth of each thing, to be filled with awe and contemplation, to recognize that we are profoundly united with every creature as we journey towards your infinite light. We thank you for being with us each day. Encourage us, we pray, in our struggle for justice, love, and peace. Amen.
This prayer, the Jewish prayer I'm going to read to you, is actually from the holiday Sukkot, which is about a week ago. So this is a week old, so it's not quite the right time for this, but it's close enough. Elohai Harachot, God of all spirit, all directions, all winds, you have placed in our hand power unlike any since the world began, to overturn the orders of creation. Please, God, give us wisdom and skillful hands to heal the skies and the earth from our sins. Yikum kurkan lichamaya. May salvation arise from the heavens, that the blessing of the sun flow over us for life and not death, for blessing and not for curse. As it says, I will open for you the expanses of heavens and will empty out for you a blessing beyond what is enough, and earth's fruit will not be destroyed because of you. God, full of compassion, remember your covenant with all life, the covenant of the waters of Noah. Spread a sukkah of compassion and peace over us, over all life species. Amen. So I can't help but notice an awful lot of similarities between those three prayers. So Joan, can you tell us, tell us more about Laudato Si and the church and climate change and environment?
Well, I thought the topic of this session, can religion or can prayer save the planet, was kind of an interesting question. And in some ways for, you know, many of us, certainly in the Catholic community and other Christian communities, that whole saving thing, savior thing, is kind of the point. So I guess I'd have to say yes. At the very least, we can play a big role, and we should. Not only can we, but we absolutely should be playing a big role in saving the planet. Now, why do I say that? And a lot of what I'm going to say is something held in common with many faith traditions, but I'm going to speak particularly from the Catholic community, since we're well represented by other communities. So why should we and can we play a big role? One is that we know about the impact and the suffering already being caused by climate change and changing weather patterns immediately and very, very closely. Just for Catholic Relief Services, we serve in 100 countries, both responding to emergencies, but also promoting development. Examples, we work with families in Manila whose homes are completely surrounded by water now. We're once on dry land, and every year they have to raise their homes because the water keeps getting higher. And the problem is there's so much garbage, because there's no garbage, trash removal system, that all of the possibilities of the outflow of the water are blocked, and that especially is the case when there's a big storm. Another example is in East Africa, where food security levels are expected to be the worst in 20 years over the next year or two. We're going to go from 2.9 million to 4.5 million people in need of emergency food assistance, and that's just in Ethiopia alone, and that is because of the drought that are coming with the El Nino effect. And of course, in other parts of East Africa and Kenya, they're expecting enormous flooding. And again, it's always the poorest of the poor who are most affected and least able to respond. One study that we did not too long ago, there are more than 1 million farmers in Central America who are growing beans and maize, who by the mid-2020s will not be able to grow their crops. So one of the things we're trying to do, and I think this is the second thing that we can bring, is that we can bring the good news that there are actually things that we can do both to mitigate these climate impacts, but also to help people adapt. And there's a very immediate need to help people adapt. So we can help these bean and corn farmers learn new techniques and to grow, teach them to grow new crops so that their families can survive. We can teach farmers in Central America whose coffee crops are being destroyed. 20% of the coffee crop in 2013 in Central America was destroyed by coffee leaf rust, which is in large part caused by rising temperatures. So we can teach them to grow shade coffee. So I think we have both the experience and we're able to tell the story, and we're of the people who are being impacted now, and we also have the good news that things can be done and they can be successfully done. We also have people in the United States alone. You know, depending on which survey you look at, there are between 65 and 70 million Catholics, and about 30 to 35 million of them attend Mass once a month or more often. So that's a pretty big network of people whose faith calls us to look at this whole issue in a particular way, and that's something we should respond to. But of course, we also have people, as do other faith traditions certainly, have people who are in positions of leadership and expertise, scientists and others, who can provide leadership on this. And then we have, of course, the Holy Father, who's providing great leadership on this. And then finally, we have a moral framework that I think is not only helpful for those 65, 70 million Catholics, but really can be something that is looked at carefully by many others. And that's what the Holy Father lifts up in Laudato Si, his encyclical on care for our common home. So just a couple of key points about Laudato Si, and then I'll turn it over to my other panelists. One is that it is important to understand that this is not a new idea, that he is drawing, I mean, you know, he references St. Francis, but even his predecessors, Paul VI is very much cited in the encyclical. Benedict XVI was known as the Green Pope. So we're kind of laughing like, is Francis the greener pope? And how the greener pope? And where are we going to go with that? Because this really has been a part of our tradition. In 1991, the bishops of the United States issued a pastoral letter called Renewing the Earth. And many of the themes that you see in Laudato Si were also covered there in 1991. So it's very much a part of our tradition. One key point there that I think is a point of view that has to be lifted up and shared more broadly is the idea that creation is a gift from God. And even people who are not believers, I think, can appreciate the idea that creation is something to be cherished and to be nurtured and to be protected. And I think that's an ethical point of view and a moral point of view that we need to lift up and promote more. Another key point that the Holy Father raises is the idea of interconnectedness. One of the key phrases from the encyclical is integral ecology, the idea that you can't think about different parts of our lives in isolation because, you know, almost everything is interconnected. And so he talks about poverty and the business community and the finance industry and labor policies, all in connection with carbon emissions and pollution and the well-being of humanity and respect for the dignity of every human person. And, you know, I think his point, in some ways, people have wanted to criticize him for not doing a definitive assessment of each of those sectors or each of those topics. And I think it's important to understand that his point wasn't to do the definitive analysis of all of those areas. His point was to remind us of that interconnectedness, and that we have to think about how all of this is related to our treatment of humanity and the natural world, and that all of that is one in creation. Related to that is the idea of both intergenerational responsibilities that we have and intragenerational responsibilities that we have, and definitely lifts that up in a very important way. How are we treating the poorest of the poor now, and what kind of world do we want to leave for our children and their children? And I think that in addition to lifting up the interconnectedness of all those areas, he makes another really important point, which is that every single one of them has moral dimensions, moral and ethical dimensions. And so whether you have a faith tradition that guides your kind of moral framework, or whether you have an ethical framework that guides your life, that business and finance and labor and technology and all these things have moral and ethical dimensions, and that is a critical lens through which we need to look at the decisions we are making in all of those arenas. And in some ways it struck me that the case of Volkswagen lifts up why that message is so important, that it is exactly what the Holy Father is talking about, that profit cannot be the primary motivator, that we have to think about the common good, that we have to think about concern for the poorest of the poor. And I think kind of related to that, that as Catholics we have a tradition called faithful citizenship. And so the idea that we have a responsibility to shape not only our own lives and the immediate decisions in our, you know, kind of personal behavior, but also shape society. And then finally, two points he makes is a call for dialogue. I think we've certainly seen a lot of evidence that he meets with everybody, he talks with everybody, and he's calling all of us to meet with each other and be open to talking with each other and listening to each other. And then finally, that this is urgent. I mean, you know, ultimately his point is this is not something that can be put off for the next generation or for some other time or place. This is now, and this is us, and we are the ones that have to step up right now and respond to the threats to our planet and to creation. So that's my summary. Let me move on to my colleagues here, and then we'll discuss.
Renee, you have you and Catherine Hayhoe are members and active in a community, frequently speak to a community that politically is not exactly receptive to the message, to the science of climate change. Can you tell us a little about how you see they work out together and the challenges there?
So I think one of the things that I always go back to is the fact that I and others like Catherine and many of our friends, we feel called to the vocation that we have, that this is something that I can't separate my faith and my vocation. I don't go to work on Monday and I turn off what's internal to me. So our values are what's carrying us through, what has led us to where we are now in terms of our passion to see the world in the way that God sees it, that it is a gift from Him, that it's something that we should cherish and protect. And so I think that when we go and we speak to communities that may have concerns about the political repercussions of climate change or the economic consequences of climate change, the main thing that we're trying to do is let people see some of our hearts, to understand that there are deeper values that we think are most important for decisions that are being made, and to try to get them to understand where creation fits in their value system, and to remind them that that we all have an obligation to serve our neighbors, to treat our neighbors as we would want them to treat us. And our neighbors are not just those who are our political allies or our bankers and lawyers, but our neighbors are people who suffer from flooding in Bangladesh, people whose water supply is being depleted in Peru, and people from just across the world. It is a difficult audience at many times to speak to, I think especially the parts of the churches in America have a very American, patriotic, independent perspective on how their religion, how their faith interacts with their politics. But we have hope that as we continue to talk, as we continue to dialogue, that hearts will be opened, and we're seeing a lot of that, especially with the younger generation. The younger generation has not been as thoroughly indoctrinated by some of the non-Christian beliefs that have crept into much of the Christian church in America, and are willing to listen and are willing to lead. And that gives us, as scientists, also hope.
Renee, isn't it also, doesn't the evangelical Christian community get in some ways wrongly accused of being very anti-climate science, because you have actual, the forgive me, I can't, it's so early, I'm trying hard to remember the name, National Association of Evangelicals has a whole creation care program and is active, isn't it, in climate change. How long has the evangelical community been doing this? And you say you've talked about yourself. This is not as isolated as people think, is it?
No, it's not as isolated as people think. Certainly, evangelical Christians for probably as long as there's been evangelical Christians have focused on helping to heal our earth and to steward our earth. I think you're right in the sense that it would be surprising for many people to learn how many scientists across our community of meteorologists and climatologists and geographers are Christian and are very motivated for finding a better way to treat our earth, and we're very motivated to understand and learn about God's creation. My thesis advisor when I was a senior in college is an evangelical Christian. My master's advisor in graduate school is an evangelical Christian. My PhD advisor, it was before he passed away, was an evangelical Christian. Many of my graduate students through the years and undergraduate students that I've worked with are Christians. And it's, I think it's not as well known both in the scientific community itself, but also just by the general public, that there are so many Christians that are involved in trying to solve some of the complex issues on climate change.
And also, by the way, totally separate, but not just climate change, you find a large community of evangelical Christians in science. And is it? Do you think the media doesn't realize that or paints it differently?
I think that I don't think that the American public in general realizes how deeply involved Christians are in the pursuit of science as a vocation. Part of that might be the media, and part of that might be that when Christians of any denomination are brought to maybe speak on television or something, that that it tends to be put into a debate where yes, we're on, you know, there might be some hand selection of people that would debate on one side of climate change, for example, more prominently than on the other side. But I think people like Catherine Hayhoe are raising the understanding in the community and the broader community that there are many of us who are believers who have been, that we feel that God has been leading us to the vocation that we have for a reason. And part of that reason may be to discover something new about creation that we haven't known before. And some of it might be so that we can bring a message of stewardship and of God's love to other Christian communities that might not see the linkage at this time.
Now, Joan, the Holy Father's encyclical is seen as potential game changer in getting the world to do something about climate change in Paris. For those who are not familiar with the Catholic faith, can you give us a very quick explanation of what an encyclical does for the faithful? What does it mean they are supposed to do? And can you also explain the role of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences here? The Pope is a scientist, despite what some politicians said. He has his degree in chemistry and worked as a industrial chemist before being called to the church. And by the way, if you have not read it, there it is, besides a beautiful religious document and scientifically sound, it has some of the most elegant writing, just from the writing point of view, which has got to be interesting because I know it was not written in English in the first. I mean, this was a translation. So whoever translated it, in addition to who wrote it, is just beautiful. You've probably only seen the more quote-worthy World of Filth, I think was the quote we all used. But it is so beautiful in that. So can you explain to us what this encyclical means?
Sure. Well, you know, an encyclical is, you know, an authoritative teaching from the Holy Father, to the people. He certainly, of the Catholic Church, he certainly addresses it to all people of goodwill who would be, you know, interested in entering into this dialogue. But for Catholics in particular, it is something that has to be taken very seriously and read very seriously. But it is not, one does not have to adhere to every point the Holy Father makes in this, that there is a whole tradition of prudential judgment around issues that don't involve intrinsic evil in the Catholic community. And so many of the things that he's talking about here are intended to nudge and guide people. And what Catholics are called to do is to read it very carefully and, in light of a well-formed conscience, make their own decisions about what they do in their lives and also how they participate in society and how they play a role as citizens of their countries and of their communities and shape public policy. So this is intended to guide Catholics in all of these areas, personal life, you know, business life, and then in public life as well. And it is certainly to be taken very, very seriously, but it is not, it is not the case that every point is something that just has to be followed absolutely, and that Catholics have the room to exercise prudential judgment using this as part of the process of forming our consciences.
Thank you. So now we'll open it up to questions. By now you've heard the rules stated over and over again. Working journalists, the SEJ members first. Our conference co-chair.
So my name is Nancy Garter. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, the Omaha World Herald. And my questions are for you, Joan. I've got two. My first has to do with something we learned the other day, and I think it might have came from a survey on religion and climate change. The survey indicated that white Catholics are the most skeptical when it comes to climate change, and I wonder if you could talk about that, why that might be, what the path forward there might be. And then the second is this. The journalist in me suspects that Kim Davis didn't get into the room with the Pope by accident, that someone within the church invited her there knowing that the controversy that would ensue. Do you, would you have any insight into whether that would be something the church would investigate, and what might follow in terms of any sort of... Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah. Okay. I got so caught up in the Kim Davis. What was the first?
Why would it be? Is it white Catholics being most skeptical group?
Of course, yes. Hispanic Catholics, actually 60%, think that climate change is, that the planet is warming and it is probably created by human beings. And only 40% of white non-Hispanic Catholics believe that, yes. I mean, I think that's clearly a challenge. In so many different areas, the Catholic community follows the kind of general culture more than it does the church's teaching. And so this is not the only area where that's the case, and I think it's a challenge for the Catholic community to really try to lift up this teaching in a more significant way. Catholics were more likely, in some of the same studies, I may have seen the same things, but Catholics were more likely than non-Catholics to be aware of Laudato Si, but not by huge percentages, you know, only by about 10%, like non-Catholics 30% and Catholics 40% or something like that. So I think we have a huge task to really bring this to the Catholic community in our schools, in our colleges and universities, in our parishes. I think there is hope that that will make a difference, but I think it has to be a very intentional effort. And so that is a real challenge for us. And then on the Kim Davis question, next time I talk to the Holy Father, I'll ask him how that happened. But in the meantime, I really don't know any more than, you know, any of us do in this room. But the one thing that I just want to lift up is that it is absolutely classic in some ways that he, you know, in the same setting at the nunciature, he met with Kim Davis, and he met with his old friend who is in a same-sex relationship. And I think that, if you know, for me, that's the really striking point of this, which is that he meets with people. And he doesn't only meet with people that he agrees with on everything. So we shouldn't assume that because he meets with somebody, he agrees with everything. But, you know, so I you know, how that happened or what will come of it, I don't know.
Yeah, there's been reporting... I've seen stories that said it was from the ambassador,
the papal nuncio, essentially
the Vatican's ambassador to Washington. Then there's a lot of politics there.
But who knows if that's even true?
What would be considered one of the more conservative faction members of in the church, and also one of the other things I believe is one, when he met with the same-sex couple, was a longtime friends. No one publicized it at the time, as there was no lawyer for Kim Davis. And that was a much longer meeting and more personal as opposed to sort of the equivalent of a meet-and-greet line, right? Isn't that the case?
Yes, that's what I understand as well, although, again, I'm not privy to his scheduler and all the details, but that's what I've read as well. So I do think that he meets with a lot of people and that we should not assume that he agrees with everything or nor disagrees with. I mean, I think we should look at his positions based on what he says about his positions and not who he meets with.
Sarah.
Hi, Sarah Terry Cobo with the Journal Record. We're a daily business newspaper based in Oklahoma City. And kind of following along the what you mentioned about coffee and teaching Central American coffee farmers to grow shade crops. This is kind of environmental justice, social justice question. It seems like if they're growing crops in the shade, there's going to be fewer coffee crops just because the nature of plantation coffee versus shade coffee. So makes it seem like the price is going to go up. So I'm interested if there's you know, any kind of effort you know, to work with, you know, people to get a fairly traded price for that, you know, in terms of, is this going to further exacerbate people's ability to make ends meet by growing less coffee? Are you, you know, working with any kind of large coffee buyers for long-term coffee prices, long-term commodity prices? I mean, when it comes to the big picture, if that's really where, you know, climate change is shifting adaptation, what's that effort, if there is one?
Yes, thank you. I would answer in two ways to that. One is that we do a lot of work on fair trade products and supporting producers who are part of the fair trade system. So we're ensuring that their products are being produced in ways that are both safe for them and good for the environment and provide a living wage for them. And we are definitely doing that with coffee farmers in Central America, and then have a fair trade program through which people in the United States, and we particularly work with parishes and schools and whatnot, can purchase and know how to purchase and where to purchase fair trade products. But at the same time, we're looking at, in the end, you know, our agriculture strategy is not to keep subsistence farmers. You want them to, and you know, we have kind of a strategy that takes them through several stages so that they get beyond subsistence and they can begin to create some income for themselves in the local markets. But eventually you want them to work together with other farmers so that they have enough product that they can then access larger markets. And we are absolutely doing that with coffee, but also with soybeans and other products, both in Central America and throughout Sub-Saharan Africa. So that strategy, we call it Pathways to Prosperity. Be happy to give you more information on it, but it's a strategy to get people from subsistence farming through the, you know, kind of intermediate stages of having some additional income to pay for school and things like that, and then eventually into accessing larger markets.
Thank you.
Okay. Next.
Marcia Johnston, I'm freelance in Virginia. Daughter of a Southern Baptist preacher. And I was curious, Renee, if you could, it's a little tough, I know, but characterize, we talked about media impressions of evangelicals and stuff and how it tends to sometime to caricature. And I'm curious if you could, the people who oppose you, I mean, the ones who just kind of don't want to talk about it or just are opposing, is it coming from a doctrinal position that they don't want to question, you know, that God's will, that, you know, that we're somehow saying we're responsible, you know what I mean, that there's a control thing there and they just want to let it go? Or is it those non-Christian elements that you spoke of that have infiltrated to the belief system, and it's the, I don't want to give up my SUV and I don't want to, you know what I mean, I'm not going to be... have my prosperity impinged upon or something? I'd be curious.
So this is just my opinion.
Okay.
My opinion is it is the outside elements that have impinged upon their life. So in any faith, you find people who are, you know, struggling through how does my faith affect my life, and we know probably of many people who they come to church on Christmas and they come to church on Easter, and in a survey they would call themselves of a certain faith or denomination, but they haven't really figured out how their relationship with God is made real on a day-to-day basis. I would also say, though, that a lot of evangelical Christians and probably people of other faiths rely heavily on the books that they can find in bookstores as opposed to going back to the Bible and really scrutinizing what it says in the Bible. So, for example, there's a book called Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey a few decades ago that really caught on in the Christian community, because really what it said is, if we look at Revelation and the end of times, that, well, thankfully, all of us Christians are going to be taken from this earth before the worst things happen and in the rapture, and therefore we don't really have to worry about it. So if the, you know, if the end of times results from climate change, then we'll be gone before the worst happens. I don't know that they're making that linkage directly, but I have a feeling that there's a generation of Christians that perceive the world in the way that they've read in books as opposed to the good book.
I'm curious.
Let me follow.
Just a follow-up, if I might. What do you use from the good book to counter that?
So I think this philosophy that they have infused in their minds has to do with the idea that we can, that God is going to save us in one way or another, that he will either do something miraculous that will save the planet or that he will take us away in the rapture. And so what I would say is that when Jesus went out into the desert and Satan continued to tempt him over and over again, basically at some point he said, do not test God. And I would say to Christians, do not test God. Do not assume that God is going to come and save us from the disasters of climate change, and do not test God and assume that he will take us off this earth before we reap the repercussions.
Let me just follow up on that with a quote from Genesis 8:22. As long as the earth remains, there will be springtime and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer. Now, your senator, Jim Inhofe, quotes that as one of his favorite Bible verses, and has said, this is what a lot of alarmists forget. God is still up there, and he promised to maintain the seasons, and that cold and heat would never cease as long as the earth remains. What do you say to that?
My Senator Jim?
You do live in Oklahoma.
I believe you mean Oklahoma's
Oklahoma Senator.
Senator.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Jim Inhofe.
He's certainly not mine. He doesn't. He's not a fan of mine.
So it's deep in my beliefs and part of the reason why I feel like I'm drawn to the vocation of science is that God created everything that we have, and God created physics, God created chemistry, and God has created all of that to work in a way that is divinely planned, and he's not changing physics and chemistry of our atmospheres and oceans and the laws that he created. And so, yes, we will still have seasons. We'll still have cold and warm. Some of our warm is going to be a lot warmer, though. So so that's how I would respond.
Hi, I'm Kevin Beatty. I'm a freelancer. I'm curious to ask about, you know, those of you who do work globally, because you know, a lot of the people, the poor, you know, listening to the encyclical, who are going to be affected by this, are in perhaps non-Christian countries, certainly outside of this country, and I wonder if, you know, if there is discussion about how do you avoid the kind of sort of conquest, I guess, that is, you know, seen as the history of mission work in the past, as you move forward in sort of helping. Rightfully so, you know, trying to counteract what first world nations have contributed to in those struggles across the world.
Sure. I think the key is, and it's something that we at Catholic Relief Services are very sensitive about, being a U.S. Catholic institution, is that we have to first and foremost be in relationship with local people, local communities. We have 4,500 staff outside of the U.S., and about 4,000 of them are local people. And so many of our staff are not Catholic, many of our staff are not Christian, because we hire and work with the local people, and we always partner with local organizations who are then in a leadership role in shaping the approach. And I think... The thing that it doesn't take much for people, Orthodox people, for example, in Ethiopia, to understand that the droughts are worse and longer, the rains have failed this year. So the idea of engaging them in responding to what's happening to our climate, you don't have to impose anything on them. They get it. You know, the farmers who have lost, you know, a lot of the poorest farmers who had the least ability to kind of respond with different kinds of technology to rising temperatures in Central America, and therefore had their crops most affected by coffee leaf rust, you know, they lost like 70% of their crop. You don't have to impose anything on them to say the changes in the weather patterns, the changes in the climate are a problem. They're coming to us saying that and saying, how do we survive in this situation? And then we work with them to figure that out. So I think it's just the approach that we take, but we're really hearing from local communities about their needs. I mean, I visited one, I'll just tell one little story, but I visited one community in Ethiopia where we had done very simple watershed management, and it involved terracing hillsides so that the rainwater didn't wash down the hill, it just soaked in, and all done with by people hauling rocks and in wheelbarrows and by hand and stuff. As a result of that, over a period of like 4 years or something, the water table was replenished. Springs that hadn't existed were renewed. So girls would spend 8 hours a day hauling water every day of their lives. That's all they did. They never went to school before this project. We piped the water into their village. They can grow their crops now. They can irrigate. They can have fresh, clean water to drink. The girls can go to school. And when we asked a group of women, what difference did this make for your village that you have this clean water project now? And, you know, you can grow your food and you can eat year-round and all of that. And their first answer was, none of our children died this year. So it doesn't take much to impose on people who are in that situation the, you know, the need to respond to this. We're responding to them, not imposing on them.
My name's Antonia Juhas. I'm a freelancer, most recently, most often with Rolling Stone. And I apologize I came in late, so you may have already answered this. But my question is, to what extent are you seeing the encyclical change, if it is, changing the views of Christians who previously thought otherwise? Is it making its way into discussions in churches and communities? And do you see it having a shift that way? And or is it possibly having a bigger effect on non-Christians and non-Catholics?
We can both answer that. I think that it's definitely a focus of discussion within the Catholic community, but I would not say that it's had enough time yet. You know, we always think about, we would like, you know, Catholic Relief Services to see Catholics all over the country, you know, committed to caring for desperately poor people around the world. But moving the needle on 70 million people or 35 million people who attend church regularly is a little tough. And so we're not going to see that in a couple of months. All of a sudden, 35 million people have, you know, transformed their point of view on these things. But I do think that it's a point of discussion. And I had said, we're going to have to think about how do we weave this. I mean, Catholic Relief Services, we've created schools, resources for elementary schools, for high schools. We have a campaign called I Am Climate Change, I Am the Cause, I Am the Solution for college students. And there are, you know, 60 or 70 colleges across the country that are launching this campaign. So I think it's that intentional effort to have the conversation and make it easy for people to bring it into their, you know, institutions and into their ministries and stuff that we'll have to do. But I don't know whether it's making a difference yet. It's really too soon to see.
Sorry, is there a formal process by which the Catholic Church is actually starting its own teachings, you know, based on the encyclical? So here is a guide for a, you know, priest in his church habit, you know, to change the encyclical into work within your own parish.
There are a number of national Catholic organizations that are producing the resources for the communities that they work with. So there are national Catholic catechetical leadership organizations that are producing catechetical resources, and there are clergy organizations producing clergy resources. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has produced resources, and all of us are part of something called the Catholic Climate Covenant. So we're working together. We're even actually working with people in English-speaking countries around the world within their Catholic community. So in the U.K., in Ireland, but also in parts of Africa that are Anglophone, where we're sharing resources, sharing videos, and things like that to try to lift up the focus of the encyclical.
I could actually tell you firsthand, because my wife teaches CCD, which is Catholic Sunday School at Holy Redeemer Church in Kensington, Maryland. And she teaches first grade, and she has in the curriculum already climate change matters. Now, so I know that it's actually being implemented.
Do you want to say something about other communities?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I was just going to say, I don't know that from my perspective, I don't know that the encyclical itself has really raised a lot of awareness, but in the American churches, I think that the Pope's visit to the U.S. has significantly raised awareness, and the incredible media coverage of the Pope's visit to the U.S. has really gotten people to listen some. But I agree with Joan. It's so climate change is slow, so is changing hearts and minds, and so that's a slow process, and we can't measure that yet today.
I will just add, though, that the night before the Holy Father arrived in the United States, I was at a gathering of national interfaith leaders in Washington, D.C., and you know, a number of people were getting up and speaking, and there was representatives of the Muslim community, of the Southern Baptist community, of the African Methodist Episcopal community, you know, and on the Jewish community, and every one of them was saying, "This is so fantastic that he's issued this statement." And you know, I'm sure there are people who self-selected were a little inclined to be supportive, but they were very enthusiastic about the Holy Father and this message and the fact that he was coming and that this could really be something that gave all a focus on this issue a real boost. And that really was across the board. The enthusiasm was exciting.
You can finish us up, Mark.
Okay. So we have the Pope, an obvious international leader of a large group of religious. We have the Patriarch, who is another obvious leader of a bit smaller group of religious. Where are the other international leaders, or how is this message expanding? Are there other organizations that are leading the way in doing this?
That's an interesting question. I don't really know, especially globally. As I said, I'm more aware of what's going on in the U.S., and there really are efforts to bring people together across faith traditions in the U.S. to look at our common interest and common, you know, kind of ethical and moral point of view on this stuff, and then to organize together to respond to it. But I can't speak to the global situation.
Well, Renee, you can.
So I would say that there are a number of interfaith groups that work together and try to carry this message, but in a lot of the Protestant denominations here in the U.S., there's no, at least I have not seen any single or small set of leaders who have taken this on as an area of their primary focus. And in a lot of the churches, I would say that it really does have to come from a more local level. So one of the things that you know, we look for and pray for is that local leaders and communities will take the message of stewardship to their communities.
Before we end this, since we started on some prayer, I thought it'd be good to end with a joke. And it's actually an appropriate one if you're from South Carolina these days. The street is flooding, and this one man is at his house. They send a fire truck comes by and says, "Here, hop on board. It's flooding. You're not going to be safe. Please hop on board." He says, "No, God will provide." The waters rise further. He's on his roof. A rescue boat comes by. "Hop in. We'll save you." "No, God will provide." A helicopter comes down and drops a line, and the helicopter people use the megaphone and say, "Grab the line. We'll bring you to safety." "No, God will provide." The water gets up. He drowns. Gets to heaven. St. Peter said, "We sent a fire truck, a boat, and a helicopter. God provided. Why didn't you take it?" So will you please join me in thanking both Joan and Renee here, especially for such an early morning panel.